you very much.
You're welcome.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to click here to the beginning of the presentation. Like Tara said, my name is Devlin O'Donnell, and I'm the Director of Crime and Sexual Assault Support Services at Western Washington University in Bellingham. Thanks again to Tara for having me do this webinar and to the rest of the staff at WICSAP. They're a wonderful group to work with. So we're going to spend the next, looks like about hour 15 minutes or so talking about safety and support groups. And I'm going to go over a little overview here for you. First of all, what we're going to talk about is why safety is an issue, why you're even spending an hour and 15 minutes listening to me ramble on about safety. Some information about safety logistics, communication, community agreements, confidentiality concerns, leaving on a bad note, which I'll explain further, and then some time at the end for questions and hopefully some answers. Like Tara had mentioned, I am happy to leave some time throughout the presentation to pause and let people ask any questions that they might be having. My goal here with this interview, or excuse me, with this webinar, was to use this time to share my knowledge with you, knowing that I'm not the only expert. I like to think that I know quite a bit about support groups, but I'm sure that there are many of you listening and participating who know just as much, if not more. So I'm really hoping that during this webinar you'll share some of your knowledge with us too. I'll stop a couple times during the presentation to give time for questions and comments, and then some time at the end. So when you're sharing, please remember one thing that's going to be really important: to abide by your rules of confidentiality. I definitely want to hear any experiences you may have had, but we certainly don't need any specifics. Just the general information will work great. So really quickly, a little bit about me. I, as the director here at Crime and Sexual Assault Support Services, or CASIS, I run our university's 24-hour hotline for survivors of sexual assault and dating and domestic violence and stalking. And so what I'm lucky enough to do is coordinate with our community's Rape Crisis Center and Domestic Violence Center called Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Services of Whatcom County. So they help me run the hotline after hours, on vacation, during this webinar, all that kind of stuff. So they give me lots of great support. And they also co-facilitate a support group with me up here at the university that we call Women Supporting Women. Before I worked here, I'm in my third year working here for the university. Before that, I was actually working at our Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Services of Whatcom County and had the opportunity to work with Tara, which was wonderful, which would be a whole other webinar. But so did a lot of work down there and ran some support groups as well. And then was lucky enough to actually do some support group work when I was interning there before I've had the job. So I've been around the support group world since about 2002, and I've really, really enjoyed it, and I think that there's so many important things about support groups, and one of those especially being safety. So let's get into the meat of it here. The first one here that I've got, I'm going to click on the slide and then give it a couple seconds in case some people's computers aren't as fast. So the first thing here, why is safety an issue? Why I am talking about this? And it took me a while to figure out why I would tell you why I'm talking about this, because when I was going through my presentation, I started thinking, gosh, a lot of this stuff just feels so simple and feels like stuff that people are probably already doing. And one of the other parts of my job up here is I do workshops on how to listen to other people and spend about an hour talking with different students or different advocates about how they're supposed to listen, you know, how they're supposed to look at one another, what types of responses to give, that kind of stuff. And so I've always talked to my colleagues and said, I feel so silly talking about how to listen to somebody for 45 minutes. Just feels so basic. But the thing that I'm really learning about is when I get an opportunity to kind of relearn some of the most basic stuff that we do, I find that there's a lot of stuff I wasn't even being mindful about. So my hope is that you'll take away some new things, but also that you'll be able to remind yourself of things that you're already doing, but that we might need to be more mindful about and do with some more purpose. So let's see here. Another reason why I think that we should be talking about this, or why I, when Tara came to me, thought that safety would be a good thing for me to talk about, is because I work on a college campus. And as I'm sure many of you know, being on a college campus, there have been, you know, recent school shootings that have happened in the past, you know, the past couple of years. So because of that, safety has definitely become a kind of a big hot word for college campuses in every aspect, but especially in my world here. So I think it's really important for us to kind of take a look at that. And then also, I find that when I start to talk about safety, I'm really always kind of trying to find a balance between, being hyper-vigilant and kind of freaking people out with the amount of safety planning that I do and stuff like that, but then also not falling on the other side and missing things that we really should be thinking about in terms of safety. So the hope here is to give you some information and to help you kind of find a balance. I'm still always searching for the balance. My friends and family will always tell me that I'm safety planning more than I probably should be. But I think it's definitely something that I've kind of tried to instill in the way that I work with survivors, and that I just kind of, we're going to go from there. The second spot on here says, while many survivors of sexual assaults may no longer be as concerned with safety from their perpetrator, there are many people we work with who are still in contact with our perpetrator. And I think that that's something for us to remember. There may be some survivors that we're working with who don't live in the same area anymore as the perpetrator, or maybe the perpetrator is in jail or is no longer alive. You know, there's a lot of different things that we could be thinking of where that might not be something that's at the forefront of their mind. But for some people, it still is. Some people that I'm still working with, and I'm sure some of you have been working with, are still in relationships with their perpetrator, may have friendships with them, may be roommates with them. For me, up here at a college campus, some of them are in the same classes or same major, so it's kind of hard for them to get away. So I think that's definitely a big reason why it's good for us to be thinking about safety for survivors, especially in support groups. All right, let's see here. Next, we're going to talk about safety logistics. So this is a list of some of the stuff that I'm going to talk about, and this is where that whole basic stuff that we all probably already know comes into play, but bear with me and see if you can find anything interesting from this. So things to think about when setting up a support group. I'm going to talk a little bit about co-facilitator, the size of your community and how that might play a role, your support group's location, time of day that a support group is held, signage, advertisement, and transportation. So the first one here, co-facilitator. I think for people who are lucky enough to have a co-facilitator, there's a lot of great benefits to having one. It can be somebody to debrief group with, somebody to have to kind of be there in case something happens during group and you might need to do some one-on-one work with somebody. You know, you can have the other facilitator of the group kind of continue to lead that group while you focus on whatever situation is at hand. This is also a good person that can help adhere to ground rules or community agreements, as we try to call them. So somebody who can really kind of help you hold the rest of the members accountable for the agreements that they set at the beginning of the group process. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a while here. But also, I think one of the most important factors about having a co-facilitator is that it's somebody that you can safety plan with. And that way, you both can decide at the beginning, you know, what are your strengths when it comes to intervening should an unsafe situation occur? How do you normally react in some sort of crisis? I think that can be a good thing to kind of get out of the way. And then, you know, it's always nice when you know your co-facilitator well, especially in those areas. So should something occur where safety becomes an issue, you both kind of know how the other one's already going to react. So I think that that's one of the big benefits about having a co-facilitator. The next part here, size of your community. So how big a role will safety play depending on your community is the question that I'm asking here. And one of the things that I wanted to think about is that I think, you know, I'm on a college campus here, so I know that I have a very different environment that I'm working in, and a very different, sometimes it's kind of like its own little city up here. But I definitely wanted to check in and note that when we're talking about safety issues and all these logistics and stuff, it might be very different for a support group that's happening in a you know, small organization in more of a rural community versus a support group that might be happening in a big city. Maybe your organization is located right in the heart of downtown where there's lots of people walking up and down the streets all the time. Maybe it's going to be in a place that's more quiet that most people don't know about. So that's something for us to be thinking about is, you know, or for you to be thinking about as we're going through the rest of this webinar is, you know, what kind of area do I live in? How am I going to be able to take this information and apply it to the support group that I'm running in my own community? All right. Next one here, location. So when we talk about safety, let's remember that a lot of times it certainly can mean, you know, we want to keep the members of the group safe from their perpetrator, should their perpetrator try to find where they are. We also want to keep people safe from anybody's perpetrator finding out that the member is in the group. We're going to talk about that a little bit more. And then also just kind of a general safety from anybody knowing that they're involved in a support group, which, you know, would identify them as a survivor, and in this case as a survivor of sexual assault. So I definitely, a lot of times, I am located in a building with a whole bunch of classrooms right down the hall from me. With I've got the president's office, and I've got a whole bunch of other offices here, the counseling center. There's a lot of different types of offices and different reasons why people are in this building, totally unrelated to survivors coming in to get support. So I definitely keep that in mind when I'm thinking about the location of the group. It's one office where the support group is held in. It's the same place where the hotline is and everything like that. So I definitely try to keep the location piece of this in mind when I'm working on the support group member safety and how obvious it is to people, or how, you know, hopefully how not obvious it is to people when the support group is going on or who's coming and going from the office. So with the location, the first little dot we have here is doors locked. And these are, again, getting down to those basics about a location for a support group. So one of the night, I always have my door locked all the time. One, for just for personal safety reasons, and two, because that knock gives me a couple of extra seconds, a couple of extra, you know, seconds of time to assess who's there and what I'm going to do about it. Unfortunately, in my situation, I've realized that I don't have a peephole or anything, so they can knock, and I've learned certain colleagues' knocks and who it is, and, you know, I've gotten pretty good at that, but I think it is beneficial to be able to have a locked door just so that you do have a little bit of that extra time to figure out, you know, who's going to be there and what to do. Also, if you're right in the middle of a support group, you don't want people walking in and out, obviously, if somebody's in the middle of sharing part of their story or talking about healing. So I definitely suggest having a door locked if possible. Windows. So initially I forgot why I put this in here and thought, am I trying to think of, you know, crafty emergency exits or something should something happen? But what I remembered, why I put it in here, was that, you know, a lot of times if there are windows in the room where a support group is happening and they're not, they don't have blinds on them, then people can see in. And I think that, you know, the support group setting needs to be very private and, you know, needs to be kept very confidential. And if somebody's talking in a room and, you know, people know that this is where people come in who are survivors of sexual assault or whatever it may be, and they see people sitting in a circle talking and maybe somebody's crying, it's definitely not gonna work for confidentiality. So I strongly suggest that if there are windows in the space where you're having a support group, to have blinds or you know, and anything, curtains, anything like that, that's going to make sure that we're protecting and respecting the survivor's privacy. All right, the next one here is exit options. So I did put this on here because in thinking about looks like I got a little note here that says, can you speak up just a little? So I'm going to try to speak up a little bit. So the reason why I had down exit options was because in my office here, I have only one door and one way to get in or out. And for me, that seems to work pretty well, but I think that sometimes it can be good to have more than one exit option. So that way, if there's some, you know, some level of concern about who might be at one door, then they're able to leave out through the other door. So that's always something to keep in the back of your mind about if people need to get out quickly, how they're going to be able to get out. All right, the next one here is the panic button. So I think it's also called like a distress alarm or something like that, but I just call it my panic button. And I, I've had some situations where being the only office on campus where, you know, it's pretty highly publicized that if anybody's a survivor that they're going to come in here. Unfortunately, I've had situations before where angry perpetrators who have just had their partner leave them because they got help from me, you know, or they seem to blame it on getting help from me, have come in very upset wanting me to fix things. And so at that point we realized that it might be good, being that I'm at the end of a hall and that I don't really have anybody down here working in the office with me, that I have a panic button. And so what happens with that is if I press it, it moves directly to our university police. And luckily for me, I'm in an area or in a community where the police station is very close to where I am. And so I am very privileged in that. I know that some people may have a panic button or may have a quick number they can call, but it takes a little bit longer to get out there. So that is one thing to be thinking about if it's something that would be beneficial to have one of those installed. And that could even be a button that notifies an office down the hall. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a police station, but I think it's a good idea if you're going to be in a setting like this to be able to have some sort of mechanism that could let people know, other people in the building, if there is something alarming going on. All right, how you leave the premises. I think that this one is really important. Like I mentioned before, just a couple seconds ago, sometimes when I have dealt with some angry perpetrators, what they talked to me about was that I was the one to blame for their partner leaving them or for convincing a survivor to make a police report or to tell family or whatever. You know, certainly I'm never going to try to convince anybody to do anything they don't want to do, but a lot of times that's how it's been seen through the perpetrator's eyes. And so I think it's very important for us to remember that as facilitators of support groups, it's also taking a risk. You're working with people who have been hurt by people who are willing to commit crimes. And I think that it's always just important for us to keep in the back of our minds, you know, how we're going to make sure we stay safe. I think that's going to be really important. And if it's on our minds, then we're setting a good example about a healthy level of safety planning. You know, certainly I wouldn't advocate for you going into a support group as a facilitator and making a huge deal about that you're taking a huge risk being willing to work with them or anything like that. But I do think that it's important for you to let them know that, you know, you make sure to plan for your own safety and that you'd be happy to help them figure out how they're going to leave as well. So I make sure, being that I'm lucky enough to work with a co-facilitator, I make sure to leave with that co-facilitator every group. We try not to leave too late at night, and I'll talk a little bit about the time of day on the next slide here. But that's definitely something to be thinking about. Also, usually when our support group is over, everyone else has left the building. And so that's something for you to think about, too. If you're running a group at a time when no one else is going to be in the building, maybe making sure to let a friend or a family member know that you leave your office at, you know, 7 o'clock, so you should be home at, you know, whatever, however long it takes you to get where you're going to be going next, just so people have an idea of where you would be. All right, the next dot here is local police aware, and normally what I do here is when I'm running a support group, I like to make sure that our university police know that there's one going on. I don't ever give out the names of the people that are involved in the support group, but I do let them know when and where that group is going to be happening, just so they have an idea and they have me on their radar and the group members on their radar, which I think can be really important. Co-location. So this is actually something that Tara brought up, and I'm glad that she did. So sometimes it might be a good idea to meet somewhere that's not the agency. Again, if your organization is housed in a way where maybe there's a big sign on the front that says what the organization is for, it might be best not to have the group in there if you have another location to go to. And I don't know where that would be. That would totally depend on your community. Could be another social service organization. Could be, you know, if depending on how, what your connections are in your community, if you know somebody that owns a bookstore or something that has a back room that they would allow you to use in the afternoon or, you know, whatever time of day. That might be something good to think about, too, in terms of safety. All right. Do we have any questions at all at this point? I'm going to allow people to unmute if they need to ask any questions that they might be having.
So if you have a question, go ahead and use that raise hand button on your screen. Hey, doesn't look like we have any questions.
All right. I'm answering everybody's questions. That's great. Or everybody has fallen asleep. Either way, it makes me feel good. So we'll keep on going, and I'll stop in a couple slides again in case anybody has any questions. All right. So the next slide here we have is time of day. And so there's a couple things that I was thinking here when I was thinking about the time of day. And I certainly think that most importantly, I know that we all have to work around our support group member schedules. And so if the only time that the way that I work with my co-facilitator is that we get in contact with any of the people that are interested in group and try to find a time that works best for the most people. And usually what happens, being that I am working with students, the majority of the time it's not on a Friday because they're all leaving town, and it's usually going to be in the afternoon. So that's kind of when I know that the groups are going to be happening normally for us. But I think that there can be some things for us to be thinking about when we're setting up group that we want to be careful about when it comes to the time of day. So the first question I have here is afternoon when perpetrator gets off work. And that was something that was brought to my attention when I was doing a support group when I worked down at the DVSAS of Whatcom County. And that was, I had a member who said, I can only come to support groups in the morning because my partner gets off work at 2 p.m. And if I'm not home when he gets home, then I'm gonna get in trouble. It's not gonna be a safe situation for me. So I can only come to support groups in the morning. And I think that was really important for me to hear because I just hadn't even started thinking about this might not be a convenient time. This might be an actual safety issue when we're looking at time of day, not just, what feels best for people's schedule, but what can they or can't they do for safety reasons. So that's something to be thinking about if the morning is going to be better for the majority of your group members, or maybe if afternoon, because that's when they can get childcare, or that's when they can get off work. So those are some things to really be checking in with your potential members about, is what their schedule is like and what is going to feel safe for them. The next one here is dark or light out, and pros and cons to both. So the reason I say that is because I think a lot of times my mind immediately goes to, I prefer to have support groups when it is light outside, just so that way I'm not going home after group in the dark by myself. So that's always something for us to be thinking about. Does it feel better to have a group during the day? One thing to be thinking about too is if you do have group when it's usually more dark outside, up here in Bellingham, during the wintertime, it's dark most of the time, so that's not much of an issue for us in the winter. But sometimes when it's darker outside, that's actually safer for survivors if they're going to be traveling in and out of the building. So that's definitely something to be thinking about. Also with that, if you have a group that starts at maybe 9 a.m. or it ends right at about 5 o'clock, whatever time rush hour might be, for some communities there might not be much of a rush hour. There's not much of one here in Bellingham. But sometimes that can be important to think about if you're having somebody leave your organization from a support group with your building, the signage on your building says the name of your organization and they're walking out right when there's a whole bunch of traffic, then that's a higher chance of them being identified by somebody they may know in the community. And that's something for us to be thinking about when it comes to safety. And then lastly, this one is mostly for me, but for anybody who may also be on a college campus or work in the schools, one thing that I have to be thinking about is I need to make sure to not end group or start group when classes are getting out. So again, I've got, 4 classrooms on the other side right next to my office here, and it's usually very, very quiet near my office, but then at 10 minutes to the hour, every hour, all of a sudden, it sounds like there are hundreds of students outside my office. So the last thing I would want to do is to excuse a group and have them leave all at the same time, right when people are rushing out of their classrooms and, running out and everything like that, especially because right outside of my office door, I have the title of the office. And so I think that is definitely an easy way to identify when somebody's coming in to get some help. All right, moving onward. The next one we have here is signage and advertisement. So what do I mean by signage? This was something when I was working on this webinar, I actually caught that I was making a huge mistake. So if this isn't worthwhile for anybody other than the fact that I have learned how to become more safe with my support groups, it is worth it to me. What I found was that on the outside of my door, I have a dry erase board. So people, I work with a lot of students who do prevention education work. So a lot of times they'll leave me notes on my door that says, hey, came by to pick up, you know, the bulletin board information or whatever. So that's usually just for people to leave notes. It's also for me to say things like, please do not disturb, be back in 10 minutes, gone for the day, things like that. What I found recently was that I was writing on my door during support group time, group in process, please do not disturb, and I also wrote the time that the group was happening. And I recognized this just a couple of weeks ago and was flabbergasted that I had missed that. So anytime people were walking by, they knew that whoever was in that room was in the middle of the support group, because right next to that was my poster for the support group and who it was for and why it was happening. It was a good thing that I was able to catch that. And now what I'm writing on my door during group time is just, please do not disturb. So that way it's a little less obvious about what's going on. So one question that I have for all of you that I'll ask is, what are some other sign ideas? What are things that you put on your doors? And what we'll do is we'll go ahead and finish this slide, and then we'll open up an opportunity, because there's a few questions here that I've been asking. So that's one thing that I'm just curious about, is what are some things that people are writing, or if they have, you know, little signs that say support group in this room or down this way. One thing that I noticed about our organization downtown here, the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Services, is that at their front door they have two big glass windows in their door, so you can kind of see inside. And the support groups that happen are normally downstairs. And so one thing I've always been kind of curious about is how to make sure to keep that information as confidential as possible about when support group is happening. Sometimes there's little signs up that say, you know, meeting downstairs, in a little arrow, which I think is a great way to do it, because it's not necessarily saying sexual assault support group downstairs at this time. So it's something for you to think about with your organization, about, you know, if your support group is happening in an organization where you can walk inside and you can go through some main doors and down a hall, and then there's a sign that says, this is where support group is. I think that that's a lot safer than having it in big letters in the middle of a building with a whole bunch of classrooms. So definitely something to be thinking about. Advertisement. So the reason I put this on here too is I wanted to check in with all of you and give you a little bit to think about in terms of how you advertise for your support groups. So with that, there's a few questions. Do you put the location of your support group on your poster? Do you put the day and time of the support group on your poster? Is your group open or closed? And what I mean by that is it just a group that people can come in to group, and is it something that's held every single week and new people can show up whenever they want and leave whenever they want? Or is it a closed group in that, you know, you get a whole bunch of people that are interested and you start a group, and at that point no new members can join the group until that cycle has finished and then a new group has started? So the way that I do my support groups is a closed support group. And that way, the reason we do that is just so the women that are in the group together have the chance to kind of create some more solid relationships, feel like they're able to open up more because they've met one another and spent some more time together. That seems to have felt best for the students in the group. So that's what we do. We do the closed groups. Also, who is your audience? So what I mean by that is, where do you put your posters? Are your posters just within your organization? Do you have posters, or is it just by referral for the clients that you get on your hotline or the people that walk into your organization? Or are they all up, you know, all over downtown, or at different organizations that are doing social service work? It's just good to be thinking about who can potentially see this information. So, could there potentially be maybe somebody's perpetrator who works in an office building where there's information about a support group, and so then they have an idea, and if they find out that, you know, the person that they've hurt might be headed that direction during group time, is that going to become a safety concern? So for some people, if their group is open, I understand that you would probably need to put your day and time on there, or maybe the location. But it might be a good idea, instead of putting that on any advertisements, is just to put, if interested, call this number. So then that way, if somebody is really interested in the group, then they could call and get more information, and then you could do some pre-screening with them. All right, so at this point, any questions or suggestions on the question I'd asked here about what are some other sign ideas?
Go ahead and use the raise hand icon.
So let's see here. It sounds like, it looks like we haven't gotten any really sign ideas. Can anybody think of, I'm really just kind of curious to hear if there's anybody who has any ideas about how they're advertising for their support group. Maybe things that I haven't mentioned yet that could be really helpful for the rest of the members to know.
Cecilia, go ahead and press *7. Hi.
Hi, Cecilia.
Hi. I think that for our group, we've been mostly depending on connecting with the service providers and having them refer people.
Oh, great. Okay.
Kind of reaching out and trying to let them know, service providers directly, that we're offering to groups, so that they're kind of letting their clients know maybe that they're reaching out, and kind of on a personal level, I mean, just kind of getting out and doing the footwork rather than, I put a write-up in the newsletter, but it's not a place or time. It's to have them call me on my work phone number so that I could contact them directly and then share the information with them rather than posting it.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That's great. So it sounds like sometimes that personal connection, that footwork, can make a lot of difference too.
It really does. And in our community, it's pretty small. So,
is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm pretty fortunate. I mean, it's not, I'm dealing pretty much with the Native community right now. Mm-hmm. But I'm also kind of reaching out into the elementary schools and stuff, so the junior highs and so.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I feel good about it.
Oh, good. Well, thank you for that. I really appreciate that. It sounds like definitely sometimes the best way to do it is just by word of mouth.
Yeah, and really if you're going to, I think, post anything, it would be just your contact information so that somebody could hopefully contact you directly.
Right.
Rather than just posting the information publicly.
Yeah, definitely. Great, thank you very much.
No problem, thank you.
All right, it looks like we've got another question here for Margaret, or a comment possibly.
Margaret, go ahead and press *7.
Hi, this is Margaret.
Hi, Margaret.
I just wanted to share another way that we found that to add to the previous speaker. If you're a local mental health agency and the therapist there, giving them packets of how they can refer their people to us, and so they do it regularly.
Oh, that's great.
They almost automatically send their sexual assault survivors over to our support groups as they're ready.
Okay, great.
That makes it really easy.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds like a wonderful relationship that you have with that organization, too.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. All right. Any other additional comments or questions before we keep moving on? All right. Well, I'll keep going, and then I'll give you time again in the next few slides to give any input or any information about how you do this work at your organization as well. Okay. Next slide. Transportation. So this one here, again, I know that my situation might be a little different in that I'm on a college campus where for the majority of the time people are either walking or taking the bus. But I did think that would be something for us to be to be aware of, especially if you're working in an organization where it is in the middle of a larger city where people are normally using buses for transportation or walking to get to and from group or to and from home. So something to be thinking about with transportation is if they're going to be taking the bus, we want to make sure that, you know, the members that you're working with in support group, that you have an idea of how they're getting to and from group. So if they are going to be taking the bus, it would probably be a good idea to make sure that your group is getting out relatively close to a time that the bus would be leaving. So that way people aren't having to stick around, you know, for 45 minutes after group has let out, and maybe it's dark outside, or maybe they have to stand outside and it's pretty cold, things like that. So it might be a good idea to try to keep in mind the bus system if that's something that's going to pertain to where you're at with your group, to make sure that people are able to get home fairly quickly before they leave. All right, the next one, walking to car. Again, this is just another important safety issue for us to be aware about. Hopefully, if people are parking near your organization, you have a parking lot relatively close, or that they're able to park in places that are relatively close to where your group is, so that way they don't have very far to walk by themselves. I'm always encouraging the group members to give each other, you know, be buddies walking the same way, or if they feel comfortable with it. Some people have even offered up giving other people rides home, which I think can be very nice. I would stray away from trying to have one member offer another member a ride home, just because that might not be within their comfort zone. They may not want somebody that they don't really know outside of group in their car with them. So, but I've found a lot of times that group members will just say, well, hey, I'm headed to the south side. Do you want to ride down that way, or whatever that may be? So that's something to be thinking about. Walking. So I think it's always good to make sure that if we can, members are not walking alone. I think it's also really important to make sure that you as a facilitator are not walking alone if you have to walk far. Again, I always make sure to walk out with my facilitator, and she is actually kind enough to give me a ride home, so then that way I don't have to walk home by myself late at night. So that's something for us to be thinking about, is how the members are getting home, and trying to make sure that they have options for themselves, but also to make sure to remember that your safety is just as important, and we want to make sure you get home safe too. So the other one that I have here is rides home, and I think that a lot of this is going to depend on the policy of your organization. I know that the policies in the organizations that I have worked with is that staff members or advocates are not allowed to give clients rides anywhere. That's a policy that my bosses have decided, and so we've had to sign agreements to make sure that I'll never be giving a client a ride home. So it might be different at your organization, and when we get to the point for questions and feedback, I'd love to hear any feedback you have about how that works for you and your organization. One big safety concern that our organizations have had is taking a member to the home of the perpetrator, and whether or not that becomes a safety issue for you. I drive a pretty identifiable car, and so I know that if I were to give somebody a ride home, maybe to the house of a perpetrator, it'd be pretty easy to find my cars. I have some bumper stickers that would, you know, make it pretty well known who I am. So that is something for you to be thinking about. All right, handouts. So when we facilitate our support group up here on campus, at the end of every group week, and I think that handouts can be a really important part of group sometimes, in that it gives people some stuff to take away with them and think about. It also may help them, give them information that they can share with other, you know, other people that they live with, or people who are trying to support them. For instance, when we do a topic on grief and loss, we give out some sheets a little bit about what you might expect in your grief, and what friends and loved ones can expect for survivors, and how to help and things like that. So that might be a really beneficial reason to give out handouts. I think there's also a couple of safety concerns with handouts, so I wanted to make sure to touch on those a little bit. One thing we do is we give the members a folder at the beginning of every group, a place for them to put their handouts at the end of each week. And so a lot of times those members will take the folders home with them. They'll put them in their backpack, and they'll take them to their dorm room or take them to their house just so that they can have them to take a look at. But for some people, it might not be safe to bring those home, either because they're living with a perpetrator, or the perpetrator might be coming over sometime soon and might find them, or because they don't want their roommates to find out that they're going to a support group. They don't want to have to answer any questions about what this information is. They want to keep that information private and confidential. So those are some things to be thinking about. We definitely leave the option for them to keep their folders here if they like and to come and take a look at them whenever they want. One thing to remember is, do the handouts have any information about the location of group? It's going to be really important to make sure not to put on there, you know, the day and time of the group, or possibly even the name of the organization if you can, to try to keep it as anonymous as possible, which is important for the safety of the organization and the group, but also important for the members too. And then lastly, one of the things that we also do is each week we give back group notes. And what that means is we take notes of kind of what happens throughout group. If people list information, one of the questions that we'll ask in group is, you know, how do you live with your anger? What do you do to handle your anger? What do you do to kind of work through anger? And so people will give off answers, and then we'll list those answers. So that's just one example of kind of reasons why we might be writing anything down. And then anything that we write down during group, we go ahead and type up and then give back to the members the next week. We do make sure not to put any names of people on the group. We only put the initials of the name of the group, which is Women Supporting Women. So we put WSW number one or whatever. And then that's all the information that we put. So we make sure not to put anybody's names or location or time of the group on there. Okay. Communication. So there's a few things to think about with communication. And what I mean by that is how you're communicating with the members of your group. One of the things that we've done in the past is we have called members of the group the day of group, maybe that morning of, to remind them about group. Sometimes for some of the students, they have incredibly busy schedules, so they've asked us to give them a reminder call in the morning so that they don't forget to come to group later in the afternoon. So something to be thinking about is we've also been asked to give out email reminders as well. And if that's something that feels safe for the members of the group, I think that that's fine for us to be doing. But it is important to be thinking about if we're going to be calling their phone, we need to find out whether or not it's safe for that, safe for us and safe for them to leave a message. One thing that I was thinking about with that too is if you're living in a small community or if you're living in an area where maybe you're well-known or the people who are involved in the support group are well-known, will other people in that home recognize your voice on the answering machine? So that's something to really think about is, will they say, you know, well, hey, isn't that Devlin? Doesn't she run that support group? Why is she calling you? So that's something that could be really important to be thinking about. Also, is there any sort of special code that they might want? So maybe they do want you to leave a message, but they just want you to say, hey, don't forget we have knitting class tonight or something like that. And then that what that could mean is, don't forget that there's group today at 4. So that's something to be thinking about too if you decided that you're going to leave a message and that's what the member of the group wants you to do. Also, is there some private email address that they would feel safe with you corresponding with them on? So do they have one that they know that their partner can't access or the perpetrator wouldn't be able to access? I think that's something for us to think about. Nowadays, working with lots of college students, they tend to want everything on Facebook. And I have refused time and time again to set up a group page for the group members where I remind them of when group is, just because I don't know enough about Facebook. I don't trust it enough to give out that personal information on there. So I would say no to Facebook, but I would definitely say if the member says, this is the best way for you to contact me, here's my private email address, then to go ahead and do that. But even when we're doing all this, to still be careful and make sure not to put the location on a message or in an email, to not put the time, to try not to leave your full name. Certainly with a name like Devlin, I have to be kind of careful. Like, it's kind of hard for me to leave my name anytime because it's a pretty recognizable name. But be thinking about whether or not the person you're calling somebody else might hear that message and might know who you are, or if your name might be too recognizable. Okay, backup story of where members are. So sometimes when I've been facilitating support groups, the members of the group have created a story of where they are instead of them actually being a group. And so for some people, I brought up the knitting one, and I actually have a colleague here who's listening to this webinar who's knitting right now, so it worked out very well. But sometimes one of the stories that we've used before is that they're taking a knitting class, which has been very useful. If they didn't want their roommates or housemates or, you know, potentially the perpetrator to know where they are, that could be the story that they're using. Sometimes I've heard, you know, I'm going to go to the gym or I'm going to go to a friend's house, things like that. But I think it's very critical that we remember to make sure that we are aware of what each member's story is, just so that way we don't get it confused. I make sure to write it down in their file, which is always locked, and memorize it the first week of group, just so that way I know. Now, to remind everybody in the beginning when I said to not be too hypervigilant about safety, I never start a group by saying everybody needs a backstory. What's going to be the code word? What's going to be this? You know, I just really make sure that if people are concerned about their safety, that I can offer that up to them. So that's always something to keep in mind. If people are in a situation where they are very concerned about their safety at that time, there are ways for us to work around it so that they can still access the group. Okay, here we go. Community agreements. And so a lot of times this is also called ground rules, and I've learned from my colleagues recently that ground rules sounds a little schooly, a little bit like we're telling people what they have to do in order to be in this group. And I think that the beauty of ground rules is that the way that we normally facilitate them, people are coming in together and making their own agreements about what they're going to want in the group in order to feel safe. So we like to call them community agreements instead of ground rules. That's what I'm getting at. So with community agreements, it's really important to emphasize the safety factor during this ground rules or agreements section of the first session, as well as the confidentiality piece. So this is kind of when you can try to find that balance between being too hypervigilant about safety or too aloof about safety, and really just let them know you think it's important that you discuss a little bit of safety measures. One rule is to make sure to let facilitators know if you, the members, don't feel safe going home. So that's what I tell them, is that one rule is to let us know if you don't feel safe going home. And what I mean by that is if physically they're not feeling safe, if they're feeling like what's going on at home isn't something that they can go back to, I really ask them to let me know and to commit to doing that. So then that way we can look into options of shelter for the evening or for however long, any contact with police that might need to happen, any protection orders that we might need to file for right away. So those are some things to be thinking about. And also, if they don't feel safe going home because emotionally they're not feeling okay. And we're going to talk a little bit more about this in a couple slides, but what if group was really, really, really intense? I think that group is always intense, and I want to respect that. But sometimes I think that there are some groups that just get very intense, and maybe some people have really big breakthroughs with healing or really big triggers that happen during group, and it's not easy for them to pack up their stuff at the end of the two-hour session and leave and go back home. So I really ask the members in the group to make sure to let me know if they're just feeling like they need more time to debrief, or they're really, really jolted by what happened during group and they need some time just to really sit in a safe space. So I think that that's important. And sometimes that's meant that I've had to stick around a little while longer to, you know, really just kind of allow them to debrief or to continue crying some more or to do some really specific safety planning. Also to do some assessment with them about, do we need to take any steps to get them some more support emotionally? So be keeping that in mind. Also with the community agreements, I think it's important to make sure to let them know that any rules that you might have about mandatory reporting, we're mandatory reporters here. And so we make sure to let the members know right away, just so that way if something were to come up, they don't feel like we have tried to trick them at all into having to get some involuntary support or having to get any sort of assessment done. So if there's mandatory reporting going on, which I'm assuming it is for most people, it's important to make sure to let members of the group know that one thing that my co-facilitator says every group, which is wonderful. She says, you know, I don't tell you this so that you'll wonder, are we sitting there just waiting for somebody to say something? Are we going to try to pick something out that they've said and then, you know, call somebody in and have somebody involuntarily hospitalized? That's not the goal of it. The goal is to make sure that they have complete control over what's going to happen in group, and that if things are starting to sound like we may have to report something, we make sure to let them know right away so that they have the option to continue talking or to figure out kind of what we need to do next. Also, another community agreement is no drugs or alcohol. And it's funny because whenever I remind people of this, normally the group members themselves won't come up with these during the community agreements piece. And I'll say, you know, it is important for us just to put down on every community agreement for every group that we do that nobody should come to group under the influence of any recreational drugs or alcohol. And then the members always kind of giggle a little bit. But I do remind them that I think it's really critical for us just to remember that, because it can be a trigger for some members. Also, people who come under the influence of drugs or alcohol might end up, there's a possibility that maybe at some point could end up getting a little aggressive or angry, and we need to think about what that might do for other members' safety. We need to let members know at the first session what will happen if that agreement has been broken. So what my co-facilitator and I do is we say, should somebody come in under the influence of drugs or alcohol, we'll have you leave right away. And then we'll call you back in. You know, we'll make sure that we'll try to get you some way to get home safely. And then we'll meet with you again before the next group to decide whether or not maybe we need to take some time away from group, or whether or not you should be coming back for the next session. With that, too, I also remind people that if you're under the influence of drugs or alcohol, that it doesn't mean you're a bad person. That doesn't mean that they're going to be banned from group for life or never be able to come back. I think that coming to group can be incredibly scary for people, and just I'm always reminding myself that anybody that's willing to walk through my office door is a huge amount of bravery and courage, and that it's a huge gift for people to come in and talk to us about what they are going through. And I think sometimes that can be a little too overwhelming, and that's why some people have shown up to group under the influence of drugs or alcohol, because they want to be here, but it's hard to really be present in that space sometimes. So I do like to remind them that it doesn't mean that they're a bad person or that they failed at healing. It just means that we're not able to have them in that space during group time if they're going to be under the influence, but that there is always an option to be in a different space at another time. All right, let's see here. At this point, I would like to open it up. Are there any other community agreements or ground rules that I'm forgetting when it comes to safety? So you'll need to click the raise hand button.
Jennifer? Star 7. Jennifer, go ahead and press star 7 to unmute your line.
Sorry, I thought I was unmuted. Can you hear me?
Yes,
we can hear you.
Okay, hi. This is Jennifer Levy-Peck from WICSAP.
Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. I think it's important under the community agreement to emphasize about sharing information with your partner at all, and just to reemphasize that, because when people are going through good periods of time with their partner, they may feel like they're not in any danger.
Right.
And yet, if that relationship turns again, as it most likely will, mm-hmm. They're not only endangering themselves, but they're endangering other people in the group.
Oh, that's a great reminder. Yes, thank you. Yeah, I definitely, one of the things that we talk about in our group too is that, you know, when you're talking with friends or family about what you're learning in group, you need to be very careful about not saying, oh, and then this one woman in group experienced this one thing, and, you know, her name is Susie, and, you know, we don't want to give out, obviously, any personal information about the person, but any really information at all. And that talking more generally about, you know, we talked about grief and loss today, I learned a lot about my experience and blah, 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 that feels okay to us as the facilitators, but nothing about what anybody else has said. Thank you, Jennifer. All right, looks like Cynthia, if you want to unmute your phone.
I have a question about what do you do when people have their perpetrators drop them off or pick them up at the location, even prior to being able to put these community agreements together?
Oh, wow. That is a really, really good question. Let's see. So what to do if a perpetrator is dropping off or picking up the member at the location before the community agreement? Well, I think that that is something that we would definitely want the rest of the members to talk about in terms of how they're feeling about safety. Maybe one idea would be if the member is insisting that the perpetrator drop off and pick up, or if the perpetrator is insisting that the member drop off and pick up, and that seems to be a big safety concern for the rest of the members, to have the member leave to go meet with a perpetrator maybe earlier or later than when the group ends, and then have the rest of the members leave either through a different exit or either 10 minutes later. That might be one idea.
What about my safety as a facilitator?
Right. That's a good question.
Because I can't leave early. I can't leave,
right.
You know, I leave later.
Right.
So I was just wondering if anybody had any ideas on that.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to hear if anybody has any ideas on that.
Personally, I think we all leave together.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So any ideas on what on the last question there? So what to do if the perpetrator is dropping off and picking up, and what are you going to do for your safety? How are we going to make sure you feel safe in that situation? Is that something that can even happen? Any ideas? If not, you can think on it. Unless it looks like Jennifer, you've got one here. If you want to go ahead and unmute your phone.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Would that be something that you could discuss when you're first setting up, when you're first encouraging a person to come to group and talking with them about that on the phone, for example?
Yes, definitely. So maybe during the pre-screening or the time before the group has even started, talking about how do you plan on getting to and from group?
Right, and being very clear, and of course they're not going to identify that person necessarily as a perpetrator at that point in there.
Right.
But to say, you know, that our preference would be if you can get here on your own, and if not, who would be bringing you, and would that person ever be someone that you might have concern about?
Right. Yes, that's a great suggestion. Thank you very much.
Sure.
All right. Okay, we're going to move on to the next slide here. Thank you very much for the questions and comments. All right, now we're moving on to a little more specifically confidentiality concerns. So certainly confidentiality is going to play a huge role in safety. One of the things to be thinking about that I think about here with group is what if there are members who are leaving the room where group is happening and somebody's walking down the hall to their classroom. What if somebody sees somebody here leave my office and then all of a sudden there's been a breach in confidentiality because that person says, oh, hey, you know, is this a support group that you just left? Or if I have bad signage that says group in process or in session, please do not disturb, then right there, that could become a breach in confidentiality as well. So if there is a breach in confidentiality, you may want to think about, can you move the group? Is that even possible? And if so, would it be a good idea to move the location to you know, maybe a different part of your building or a different building altogether, if you can move it to a different day or time. Now, I know that that could be difficult depending on how many members in group you have, how busy your schedules are, whether or not there's going to be any other times available for the room you're trying to use. But those are some things to be thinking about. At what point, you know, do we need to start thinking about whether or not the group itself has to change in terms of location, day, or time? So safety within group. What if one member's perpetrator finds out? This is something that I have talked with a lot of people about and have talked about with for a few years, and I don't think I have an answer, and I would be curious to hear if anybody else does. There's been some people who I've talked to that say, you know, to move the group to a different place, so that way the member who's still in the group has access to the group. And then I've had other people tell me to ask that member to no longer be a part of the support group for the other person's safety. And I don't know which one is right. I would hope that if there was a situation in which we need to ask a member to leave because their perpetrator may find out, that we don't cut off communication with them. That we find another day and time that might work for an additional group, or that we offer up individual meetings with that member so that they can still get that support. I know that there was a member that I worked with in a group who just decided that she loved the information we were talking about in group, but did not feel comfortable in a setting where there were so many people. She didn't like being in such a large group. And so what we had decided was that she would come in and we would run through group, but it was just her and I. And so that way she could still participate in the group, and we could talk a little bit about, you know, whatever topics were going on, but we did not do it in a group setting. So that's something to be thinking about too. And again, I really, you know, the idea of having to ask a group member to leave because, you know, the perpetrator finds out doesn't really sit right in my stomach, but I also really understand at some point we need to be figuring out what's going to be best for the group as a whole, and also what's going to be best for the facilitators. So again, this is a big reminder of why confidentiality agreements are so critical. So when the first session of every group, we have each one of our members sign a confidentiality statement, and we ask them to really agree with each other and say that they're going to be okay with what they've all asked for. The confidentiality agreement on the facilitator's end is, you know, we're not going to tell anybody, you know, your basic confidentiality stuff. We're not going to tell anybody that we're working with you, what your experience is, why you're in group, any of those things. We also let them know that if we were to see them out in the community, or if I were to see them on the bus or on campus or something like that, that my initial response is to always act like I do not know who they are. I just, you know, walk by like I don't know them. And then at that point, it's their choice if they want to say hi or, you know, or not. And then I'll just kind of follow their lead, which I think can be really important just in case they're, you know, they're with one of their friends from their, you know, from their math class or their roommate or something. And then they say, isn't that, you know, the person who runs the hotline? You know, like, why are you talking to her? So I think that that's really important for us to remember, too. Or if I'm downtown and I see somebody who has been into the office before, I'm always very careful to not acknowledge them. And I tell them that that's hard for me, that I would love to be able to smile and ask them how they're doing, but that, you know, more importantly, I want to respect their privacy. And knowing that, you know, I think I'm pretty cool, and I think people like talking to me, but at the same time, they don't want to talk to me all the time. And so I want to give them that option to not have to engage in conversation with me, you know, if they run into me at the grocery store or something like that. So again, this is the big reason why confidentiality agreements can be so critical, because I think a lot of it really just encompasses safety all the time. One of the things that the members talk about too is when they see each other, how are they going to interact with each other? And so some of them kind of form a bond pretty quickly, and they'll say, you know, like, you can tell that there's some members who just say, oh, I don't care, say hi to me, no big deal, say that we're from the same knitting class or something like that. But I think that at the end it is really important that they all kind of agree on how they're going to interact with each other outside of group in order to keep it as safe for people as possible. And again, I think it's also really important to remind the members in the first session about what will happen if confidentiality is broken. So depending on you and if you have a co-facilitator, whatever you all have decided about what to do if somebody breaks that confidentiality, what are the steps you're going to take? Does that mean that person can no longer be in group, or does that mean that there needs to be some meeting that you have individually with them? Does that mean that the other members of the group get to decide what happens? So all those things are important to be thinking about. Okay, I've got a couple more slides here. We're doing great on time. Leaving on a bad note, member safety. And so I put this here because I'm hoping that we're not going to leave on a bad note, but that I think that I've mentioned this before, that sometimes when we're talking about safety, we talk a lot about the logistical safety part of it, but what about the emotional safety piece? I'm sure many of you participating in this webinar have experienced a group session that got very intense very quickly, or where something was said and people had very strong reactions to that, either by something that maybe a facilitator said or something another member said. Maybe somebody was triggered by something. Maybe somebody already came in having a hard day and the topic itself kind of really ended up being a lot harder for them to handle than they thought it was going to, or harder for them to sit through than they thought it was going to. So a lot of times I've been in experiences where that kind of stuff has happened right near the end of group, and then people are leaving to catch their buses. They've got people picking them up. They've got places they've got to go. So how do you make sure that people are safe leaving? And by safe, I mean in terms of self-harm assessment, safe in terms of having enough time to be able to debrief or to continue to cry. We want people to feel emotionally safe when they're leaving group. And so I think that it's really important for us to think about that, should something really intense happen, or should somebody have a really big breakthrough, a really big trigger happen during group, that we, at that point, we need to give them ample time to get grounded before they leave. And so that could be doing, you know, deep breathing with them if that's what they want. It could just really be sitting with them and allowing them to kind of talk and debrief about what's going on. Sometimes I've had members who say, I just want to sit here for a few minutes. You can feel free to, you know, do all your closing up and stuff. I don't actually need you to talk to me. I just feel like I have to sit on this couch a little bit more before I head back out into the world. So it's really about trying to check in with the emotional level of where people are at and what they're going to need if things have gotten really intense. I've had to ask people before to kind of do a big group deep breathing before they've left when things got really emotional. Really asking them also to support one another too. I think sometimes, especially if you're running a group by yourself and then you have five or six members who are getting, you know, really emotional, who maybe many of them have been triggered or many of them have really had these big breakthroughs and need lots of support, it's okay to say, remember the other members of this group, remember who you're on this journey with, and allow them to really try to support each other too. So again, sometimes that might mean staying later if need be, giving them tools to get grounded after they leave. My co-facilitator and I, she's always really good about asking them to share, you know, one thing that they're going to take away from group and one thing that they're going to do for themselves in terms of self-care when they leave. And so sometimes it takes the members a little while to think about something, but we can say, you know, even something small, like, are you going to listen to your new favorite song, or are you going to go take a bath, or are you going to go for a walk, or whatever that might be. So just making sure that they have one little idea, whether or not they actually do it, they've got one little idea in their head of what they can do to take care of themselves after they leave. All right, let's see here. And then lastly, leaving on a good note. So what do you do to keep yourself and other members safe? And then at this point here, you know, we have the next 10 minutes to have any questions or feedback or comments that we might have. But I do really want us to remember that one of the biggest gifts we can give our clients is by taking their safety seriously. And I really, really believe that. Call it nurture, call it concern, but it all boils down to advocacy. I've definitely been called by many coworkers kind of this den mother, or somebody who tends to be always concerned about people's safety and emotionally and physically. And I think a lot of it just boils down to us wanting to be there to make sure that the people who need our support are able to keep themselves as safe as possible, and that we can be there to try to help them figure out what that means for them whenever we can. So at this point, I want to open it up to hear from all of you about what you do to keep yourself and other members safe. If I'm missing anything, any experiences you think might be useful to share with the rest of the group. And so just remember, if you have an idea, to go ahead and click that the question, raise the hand button. All right, two. Yay. Okay, looks like Patricia lit up first. So if Patricia, you want to go ahead and hit your unmute button.
Star 7.
Hi. Actually, this is Beulah. I'm doing this with Patricia.
Uh-huh.
And my question is, how are you addressing the new technology, like with Google's new download system, where you can just take a phone number and find out where anybody is in a matter of moments?
Oh, that's it. You know, I'm unfamiliar with the technology. So you mean like anybody's cell phone number?
Well, they can do it with any cell phone number, any number. You can just Google, you can download a program to Google,
mm-hmm.
and then you can just know where any person is pretty much across the world, but definitely across the United States. And if you are sharing cell phone plans with someone, you could do it just without even the download, just going on to online and doing it with all our GPSs and our cell phones.
My goodness, well, that sounds really scary. do you know if the phone has to be on or off for that to happen? Or if the phone is off, then it wouldn't work? Or
You have to actually go in and turn off your GPS part of your phone.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And in some phones you can't.
Wow, okay. So, gosh, well, I would love to know the answer to that question. I think it might be I'll tell it to Tara, maybe something that might be really useful is having information about this kind of technology and how to keep people safe with that. Because, and it seems like nowadays there are so many different types of technologies where people can figure out where you're at and what you're doing, and I don't seem to be up on that stuff. So thank you for that suggestion.
Yeah, it's an ongoing concern, and WCSAP and WCSCATF jointly do tech safety training periodically throughout the year, both on webinars and at conferences.
Oh, great. Okay, good. All right, well, thank you, Patricia. And then we've got Heather here.
Heather, go ahead and press star 7.
Hello, this is actually Josh from Walla Walla.
Oh, hi, Josh.
There's a bunch of us here.
Oh, good. Well, hello, everybody.
Hello.
I just wanted to, about the self-care part when leaving, taking care of yourself.
Uh-huh.
I think reminding people that they don't have to figure it out right afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, taking a walk, taking a time out is sometimes really important. So,
that's
kind of what we do, I think, at the end of each group.
Yeah. That you do for yourselves as well?
Oh, yeah, I drive.
Uh-huh. So that can help you take some time out too, right?
Yeah, that's my little time out.
Oh, good. Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think that reminding people that, yeah, they don't have to be on and always actively trying to heal 24 hours a day, I think that would be exhausting. So reminding them that part of their self-care could be taking time out to not think about it and to relax, go for a walk, go for a drive, kind of let some of that go for a little while. I think that that sounds great. Thank you.
Star 1.
Good. All right. Any other questions, feedback? I'm putting my contact information up here for you so that should you have anything you want to ask me or contact me about, any feedback you might have, we've got my phone number and my email address up there. But any other last questions or comments before we finish up? That's it. Thanks again for letting me try out this whole webinar thing. I really enjoyed it, and I hope that people got some useful information from it.
Thank you so much for sharing your experience and expertise, Devlin.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right, everyone. Have a good day. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.